I was appalled, and indeed the whole department was, and frankly, angry, to learn of the MCC's failure to adequately secure this prisoner. We are now learning of serious irregularities at this facility that are deeply concerning and demand a thorough investigation. The FBI and the Office of Inspector General are doing just that. We will get to the bottom of what happened, and there will be accountability.
Attorney General William Barr speaking at a law enforcement conference in New Orleans this morning about Jeffrey Epstein, the accused child sex trafficker. Epstein apparently killed himself over the weekend, even though he was supposed to have been closely monitored by guards. He was in the secure housing unit in a Manhattan jail. It's called the Metropolitan Correctional Center, and it's run by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. His death is raising serious questions about the conditions of prisons and jails across America. Andrew Cohen has written about this for The New Republic. He specializes in criminal justice. Hi there.
Hi.
So this was run by the Bureau of Prisons, but for a long time, the MCC has had a pretty bad reputation. The LA Times once called it the Guantanamo of prisons. And so was this a surprise to people who have been following conditions in jails, and especially this one, that this suicide happened, this apparent suicide happened?
I mean, I don't think anyone who follows closely what happens inside prisons and jails can ever be surprised about a suicide. Obviously, you're a little bit surprised that such a high-profile prisoner with such political ramifications would be allowed to have access to a moment or an hour or more to commit suicide. But, you know, that quote that you have, that soundbite from the Attorney General, is just unbelievable, because there's no reason in the world for him not to have known before this happened that the Bureau of Prisons, which is run by the Justice Department, has a huge, serious problem with suicides, with mental health, with understaffing, with overworked guards. None of this should have been a surprise to the Attorney General. It'll be fascinating to see whether this, with all of the attention drawn to it, actually generates the kind of reform that's necessary.
Okay, so when he said serious irregularities at this facility, he said, we're just learning now of serious irregularities. That's what you're talking about? You're talking about the...
There's no way he's just learning now about serious irregularities at the New York Detention Center or really anywhere. If he's just learning about it now, he hasn't been paying attention. A part of it is a budget problem. Part of it is just the fact that there isn't a full-on director at the Bureau of Prisons. All of these problems were known or should have been known to the Attorney General before this happened over the weekend.
And is the primary problem that these prisons are overcrowded and understaffed?
Yeah, I think that's one of them, right? Understaffed, overcrowded, people who don't have adequate training to handle suicidal prisoners, mental health professionals who are charged with identifying people who may be suicidal are just overwhelmed by the amount of work that they have to do. The Bureau of Prisons often has trouble finding good quality people because of the differences between private and public pay. You know, these are all systemic problems, but they are not new. And in fact, a couple of years ago, the problem of suicides within the Bureau of Prisons was so significant during the Obama administration that they actually sent a memo. Federal prison officials sent a memo to all the inmates that basically said, look, if you're troubled, if you're feeling down, if you're depressed, if you're suicidal, get help. You can't ask for help. And if you ask for help, we're going to try to give you help. I wrote about one inmate who took that letter seriously, went to get help, said that he was suicidal, was found by doctors not to be, and then was punished for coming forward to say that he was feeling emotionally unstable. That's the kind of record you're dealing with here. I can't imagine it's gotten much better in the past few years.
And in this particular case of Jeffrey Epstein, he apparently tried to do this before, a week or two ago, but was taken off suicide watch.
Right. He evidently tried to commit suicide 3 weeks ago at some point in late July and was taken off. Now, it's unclear at this point what exactly happened. There have been reports suggesting that maybe his lawyers pushed to get him off suicide watch because it is so restrictive compared to other conditions of confinement, but he was in special housing. It's called the SHU, S-H-U, which means that he was under restrictive housing anyway. So I don't know how that all plays out. But the fact that you have a prisoner with a history of suicide attempts in a very dramatic moment in the history of the case, where new revelations are coming out, where bail has just been denied and so forth, that is an at-risk prisoner. Mm-hmm. Whether that prisoner was high profile or not, whether he was on or off suicide watch or not, he should have been closely monitored to the point where he could not have accomplished what he accomplished, I guess, Saturday morning.
Right. So there are other high-profile stories. We heard of Sandra Bland, for example. She was found hanged in a jail cell in Texas. I'm not sure if that jail was overseen by the Bureau of Prisons, but even if it wasn't, it does indicate that this is a problem that happens throughout the system.
Right. That was a local jail in Texas. And that's part of the problem here, is that we see a high rate of suicides, not just among long-term prisoners in state prisons and federal penitentiaries, you know, people who have given up hope because they've been incarcerated for so long, or who have become mentally ill because of solitary confinement and so forth. That's one class of people who tend to try to commit suicide or commit suicide or engage in other acts of self-harm. Then there are the people like Sandra Bland who commit suicide or who are believed to have committed suicide in local jails days maybe after they've been jailed. Mm-hmm. You know, they may be in jail for the first time. They think their life is over. They panic. They become depressed. And they have these scenarios. And clearly, local officials in these jails are not equipped for this, which is why I think the latest statistics tell us that suicides are the leading cause of death in jails, not in prisons, but in jails where populations are more transitory. But, you know, to me, the story here is that this was a problem that the Attorney General and everyone else within the Bureau of Prisons and the Justice Department should have known about. This was a particular prisoner that should have been under special care and watch just because of the political ramifications of his case, his connections, all the conspiracy theories that the Justice Department knew or should have known would emerge if there was a death here. So it makes the the problem that more magnified. And again, the open question now is Congress says it wants to investigate. The Justice Department says it wants to investigate. The FBI says it's already investigating. What is going to come from these investigations? Is there going to be some sort of commitment to ensure that people in this situation are monitored in a way that's, you know, safe for them and also safe and fair for the people who have to do the monitoring?
Andrew Cohen is senior editor at the Marshall Project and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, almost immediately after Epstein's death was announced early Saturday, conspiracy theories roared into action online on both the left and the right sides of Twitter. President Trump retweeted the right's theory that the Clintons were involved in his death. The left argues it was Trump and Attorney General Barr who were likely behind it. In an opinion piece in the New York Times, Charlie Warzel says this back and forth has marked a new low for our post-truth world. And he's here now. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so we have hashtag Clinton body count and hashtag Trump body count as trending topics on Twitter. What are the main arguments if we need to actually go into them?
Basically, there were two hashtags in the immediate aftermath of the reports of Epstein's apparent suicide. The hashtag Trump body count sort of linked or suspected that, you know, Donald Trump or people close to Donald Trump had something to do with this, that Donald Trump has ties dating back, you know, many years to Jeffrey Epstein, and that, you know, perhaps he knew too much. So that was the alleged supposition behind that hashtag. On the other side, you have the hashtag, which was Clinton body count, which was basically doing the exact same thing, but tying the suspicion of foul play to the Clinton family, that that they had ties to Epstein, especially former President Bill Clinton, and that that there was, you know, possibly some foul play as Epstein, you know, as his trial was seemingly imminent.
Mm. Right. And so then that just takes off. And then there becomes like this strange chicken egg situation where mainstream journalists have to talk about it, like we're talking about it right now, because it becomes a thing on Twitter, even though it's a thing on Twitter because it's a thing on Twitter, you know, because people keep retweeting.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what I have sort of dubbed the cycle of newsworthiness that we get into, which is really, you know, more of a trap than anything else. As you just said, because something is talked about a lot, we feel that it is, as the media, that it's part of a national conversation, and then we amplify it, sometimes, you know, rather uncritically or without thinking about the motivation. So I feel like this was a great example on Saturday. You saw people from both sides of the fringe put these hashtags out into the world. Those were then aggregated and put into Twitter's trending topics. And journalists who are, you know, scouring Twitter see that these things are trending and, you know, somewhat rightfully, perhaps not rightfully at sometimes, interpret them as a signal of importance. And because they see, oh, everyone's talking about this, they start to tweet and write stories and put that into context. And it just perpetuates itself, really.
Yeah. And then it's not just everyone. It's someone in particular, too. It's the president of the United States.
Right. And that was sort of the, you know, the cherry on top of the conspiracy sundae on Saturday evening. Donald Trump retweeted one of the conspiracy theorists, you know, linking this supposed suicide to the Clintons. And journalists, you know, there were some who treated this, you know, the proper skepticism, but there were quite a few mainstream journalists on the internet who, you know, retweeted the tweet and simply only to point out this is the president of the United States saying this, and didn't wrap it in any context. And you know, what you are doing there to some degree is also continuing to amplify, just as Donald Trump did. And I understand that, you know, so many journalists feel that this is obviously aberrant behavior for a president. This is very newsworthy that he is consuming and amplifying conspiracy theories. But at the same time, there is a rather uncritical thing that's happening where journalists aren't wrapping this in the proper amount of context and are, to some degree, amplifying this.
But then there's a catch-22 there, because if they don't talk about it, then people think, well, what are they covering up? Why is the media silent? Are they in league with whoever is in league, some dark shadowy force?
It is our job as the media to not necessarily always act as a gatekeeper per se, but to be rigorous about this, to report the facts when they arrive, and not to spend all of our time, you know, vamping to fill space and then confusing people. What I noted in my column was that, you know, a very interesting thing happens on Twitter, which is when a major breaking news story takes place, Twitter is magnetic. People flock to it because you can get this up to the second information, and it is a wonderful place for that. But big breaking news stories develop slowly, usually. The facts trickle in. Mm-hmm. They don't just pour out right away. And there is a sort of a chasm between the amount of attention that is focused on the platform and the amount of actual, you know, true factual information that's out there. People tend to fill that. Often the worst actors, those who are, you know, ideologically motivated, fill that with untruths or propaganda or easy answers or rumors.
Right. But as you note, this particular story seems just tailor-made for all the conspiracy theories on all sides to flourish, because here you have a supposed billionaire, although that's in question. We don't know exactly how he made his money. He was flying around on private jets with powerful people. There's a child sex trafficking ring, which always seems to pop up in these kinds of stories. It just seems to be tailor-made for conspiracy theories.
Yeah, the Epstein saga, however, whatever you want to call it, it's sort of a conspiratorial fever dream. It is the nightmare scenario for those of us who are trying to guard against conspiracy theories. One of the things that has been so difficult about the last couple of years, a lot of the main stories in the news, whether it is, you know, the Mueller report and the specter of potential Russian interference in our elections, so much of it is tied up in conspiracies. And some of them seem to be at times truer than others, or components of it are truer than others. And when you have conspiracy sort of bleeding into our legitimate real news stories, there's a real blurring of fact and fiction. I think this is such a tremendously difficult time, not just to be a journalist, but to be a consumer of news, to be someone who wants to keep up with this stuff. And I think that we should be really honest with readers that we don't always have all of the facts. Obviously, the facts aren't out. There are obviously politicians and powerful people asking questions about what happened to Jeffrey Epstein. And that's understandable. We're in a period of time right now where we don't have all the information. And when we don't have that information, that is probably the most dangerous time for all these theories to flourish.
Well, thanks, Charlie.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Charlie Worzel. He's an opinion writer at large for the New York Times. Coming up, what's next in the Epstein case? Now that Epstein cannot be tried, the legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, Jeffrey Epstein was facing sex trafficking charges. So what happens now to that case? It's Monday, so that means Jessica Levinson is here. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal eagle here on Press Play. Hi.
Hi.
Well, prosecutors say they will continue to pursue this, right? So how are they going to do that?
Well, not against Jeffrey Epstein, right. Obviously. So there is the potential of conspiracy charges, which means conspiracy charges against co-conspirators. So the reason that prosecutors have put out a statement saying, look, if you're a victim, we still want you to come forward. We still want you to bring us information, is because that could help to the extent that there's anyone else who could be charged for related crimes, essentially aiding and abetting what Jeffrey Epstein was doing.
So someone now, like Ghislaine Maxwell, who has been accused of being his madam.
Exactly. Now, there is a big question mark over that, because if they had enough evidence about any of those co-conspirators, why did they wait? Why didn't we see an indictment prior to that? So I think there's maybe some hope by prosecutors that, well, now that people wouldn't have any fear of retribution because Epstein has died, maybe more people will come forward. Maybe they'll feel like we have to get justice in some way. But that's the only way that a criminal case could go forward.
Right. And so is there any way that the prosecution can now get any kind of evidence or communication between that happened between Epstein and his lawyers?
So the attorney-client privilege survives death. And so probably not, with some exceptions. I mean, courts have allowed attorneys to provide information, for instance, if it's needed for a will contest or to prove what you meant in your trust. But I don't think that that's likely. What's likely is that there's evidence that was in a grand jury. There's evidence that I think is subject to FOIA requests. I don't know that the public will ever see all of the evidence that was going to be put forward in this case. But there are other cases. There are civil cases that have already started against Jeffrey Epstein, for instance, for defamation. There could be civil cases against his estate. That's why some attorneys have said, estate, don't pay everybody out. Please freeze the assets, because people might try and get some vindication that way.
Right. And we don't even know what his assets are. Everything has been shrouded in mystery.
We don't know, but that could be a way to find out, right. Which is, if there's money there, it might ultimately have to be paid to some victims.
Okay, let's turn to another story now. A conservative activist group called Judicial Watch is suing California over its brand new law that requires at least one woman to sit on corporate boards of publicly traded companies that are headquartered here in California. This is a first in the nation law, I believe. And so in the lawsuit, this group is saying that using taxpayer money to enforce this law is illegal. How is it illegal under their argument?
So first in the nation, but not first in the world. This law was actually modeled after some laws in the European Union. And so what they're saying is they basically have to say taxpayer dollars were misused because it's a taxpayer suing. So that's the way they have standing essentially to say, like, here's a person who's hurt. This is the right person to walk into court. Their argument boils down to this violates the Equal Protection Clause because you're treating women different from men and essentially creating a different category and quota to ensure that a certain number of women will sit on these boards. And what they're saying is the Equal Protection Clause, it doesn't just protect minorities. It doesn't just protect women. It goes both ways. It says treat people equally.
How is this different from affirmative action?
So it, in some ways, looks a lot like affirmative action. Affirmative action, in the way that we've understood it when it comes to, for instance, universities or colleges, is different in the sense that you don't really have these strict quotas or you get a fine by the state government. And instead, what it allows is for colleges and universities to have as one factor of their admissions process, increasing diversity of the campus. But certainly this has been hotly debated. There are other legal issues dealing with essentially whether or not the government can reach into private corporations, even if they're publicly traded. And if there's a corporations code issue here in the sense, can you reach in and say you are forced to have these people on your board, forced to have certain gender diversity on your board, or else you face a fine? Now, of course,
but there are all sorts of things that corporations are forced to do, like adhere to environmental laws, minimum wage laws, all sorts of labor laws. So
pay taxes.
And, yeah, all sorts of things.
Yeah. So the question when it comes to the government basically forcing private actors to do anything is whether or not, when we're kind of balancing like government power versus private power, is there a good reason to do it? And is there any statute in place which would say the private corporation has essentially free reign over this? Like, you as a private corporation or publicly traded corporation, you have to pay taxes, you have to give a certain amount of leave for people to care for either infants or sick family mm-hmm. members, but you have control over who's on your board. We don't tell you that. And that's part of the question here.
Okay. And finally, California's effort to automate voter registration through the DMV, the motor voter law, is facing yet another scandal. The LA Times reporting that DMV offices produced more than 80,000 duplicate records and that there were something like 200,000 documents with mistakes on them. How did this happen?
Oopsies. So, well, let's take a step back and say, why do we have this law at all? So where you have a lot of states in the nation that are kind of pulling back on voting rights, saying we're going to reduce early voting, we're not going to have as many voting centers, we're going to increase requirements like, say, that you need a voter ID. In California, we're doing the opposite. And we've been doing that for quite a while, where we're trying to essentially almost drag people to the polls. And this law is about automatically registering people to vote so that when you get your ID card from the DMV or your driver's license, you have to opt out in order mm-hmm. to not be registered to vote, which of course means you're much more likely to be registered.
Right.
We also allow for pre-registration when you're 16 and 17. And so the idea is, well, let's just make it simple. You're already essentially having an interaction with the mm-hmm. state government. So when you go in there, why have this whole extra step? Now, the problems have obviously been numerous. John Myers from the LA Times has been reporting on this in great detail. And essentially, it sounds like the infrastructure just wasn't in place, that there were too many different state agencies trying to talk to each other, but talking in different languages and being in silos that didn't interact. And so we have a situation where there were duplicate registrations, where there were errors in registrations regarding party preference.
Okay, but nothing that can't be fixed.
Nothing that can't be fixed. And I think the key takeaway is absolutely no evidence that this made its way to the voter rolls and no evidence that this affected anyone's vote, that anybody voted twice, that there was any voter fraud.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal Eagle here on Press Play.
Thank you.
Coming up, why liberal Sausalito is at the center of a desegregation fight, and brushed off as vanilla pop initially, the Carpenters' music has endured a critical appreciation.
It's the range of that voice that is the thing that's kind of captured people's imaginations and has been a real enduring thing. And what makes people read sadness into it, even when she's singing very sunny and optimistic music.
Yeah. Why the Carpenters matter. That's coming up later on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Sausalito is a wealthy liberal town just north of the Golden Gate Bridge in Marin County. It is a beautiful part of the world. But the school district there has been engaged in some really ugly racial segregation. California Attorney General Javier Becerra accused the district of intentionally separating students based on their race and income. The wealthy, mainly white kids, go to a fancy charter school. The poor, mainly black and Latino kids, to another school that's not as fancy. Well, under pressure from the state, the district has agreed to change things beginning in the next school year. And here to tell us more is Mackenzie Mays. She covers education in California for Politico. Hi there.
Hey.
Well, Becerra said the segregation of these schools was intentional. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, he was not shy about that. And I think that's what makes this case so important, is because we talk about how school segregation is still a real thing, even after all these years, after Brown versus Board of Education and all of these cases that focused on desegregation. But he was very clear that this was intentional and deliberate, and they can't release all the details about that because it is a DOJ sort of sensitive case. But he essentially said, we wouldn't be here today and talking about the settlement if somebody hadn't done this on purpose.
Like overtly said, we're going to put these kids here and those kids there, like that.
Yeah.
Deliberate?
Yeah, he made it clear that there was proof of that school board leadership, which is no longer around, said, we are going to intentionally push these kids into one school and these kids into the other.
And why won't we see that evidence?
Maybe we will one day, but he was getting questions from the press and it sounded like we're not going to get it all right now.
Uh-huh.
But he made it clear and he called people wicked and corrupt.
He used those words, wicked and corrupt.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay, tell us about these two schools. One of them is Willow Creek. The other one is Bayside Martin Luther King Jr. Academy.
Yes. So one school is this whiter, wealthier school that has great programs, and the other is a minority school. It's under-resourced. And that was a big part of this case, too, is that as soon as there was this deliberate intention, alleged deliberate intention to create this Bayside school, immediately it got less resources. It started to fail in ways that the other wider, wealthier charter school wasn't. And so that was a big point of the announcement on Friday, too, is that not only were these differences made, but there's a difference in resources as well, and therefore academic achievement.
And one of them, the wealthier school, is a charter school. So that is already a big issue when it comes to charter schools in California. They're seen as, catering to a more advantaged population, shall we say. There's a lot of debate over this. So how will this play into this debate about charter schools?
Yeah, for sure. When the story came out and we realized it was a charter school, I felt like there were some organizations. It was like a collective once, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a huge battle brewing in the Capitol here in Sacramento about legislation that would crack down on charter schools. And this sort of exemplified the very criticisms that groups like the California Teachers Association has, which is that they believe that some charter schools, because they don't have to follow by the same rules as traditional public schools, can cherry pick the best and the brightest, and in many cases, whiter, wealthier families. And CTA's argument and other groups who are anti-charter schools' argument is that that just worsens the achievement gap that we already see in all of our schools, and takes away resources from the entire system. Now, there are charter schools that specifically serve less advantaged students or minority students. And so the Charter Schools Association will point to these charter schools that are doing really great for these groups of students. But this was kind of an example of what people say is the worst of the worst of these cases.
Right. Well, okay. So the district agreed to desegregate beginning in the next academic year and complete the process in about 5 years. What are they going to do?
So they have to have this very comprehensive desegregation plan, and a third party will be hired to oversee it and make sure that they're doing it right. And another interesting element of this agreement is that some of the kids that attended Bayside during these years will actually get college scholarships as part of the settlement.
Will there be busing?
That's a good question. And I think, aside from the charter school part, that this is why people are paying so much attention, including national outlets far away from California are interested in this case, because school segregation has sort of been thrust back into the spotlight because of what we're seeing in presidential debates and really emotional conversations about busing and segregation between candidates like Harris and Biden. So I think everyone has their eyes on this.
Right. So Kamala Harris, she was the attorney general, and didn't this investigation begin under her?
It did. Yeah, it was opened while she was AG.
I see. So I guess in the broader picture, though, this is not the only district that is segregated in California or anywhere in the country,
yeah,
for that matter.
Yeah.
Was this one just particularly egregious? Why was it singled out?
I think that the attorney general mentioned that it had among the worst discipline disparities. So we already know that minority students are disciplined at higher rates than white students. And in these two cases, those were some of the stats that were really jarring. But I used to cover education in Fresno, and I can tell you there's blatant school segregation in some ways there, that the schools in a city next door have higher academic achievement, that the demographics are so much different, whether it's race or free and reduced price lunch. So we know that there are seemingly segregated school districts all over California and across the country. But this, I think, is an important case because we have someone making it someone's fault. I think there's a lot of debate about who we can point a finger at when we realize schools are segregated like this. And our attorney general in this case is making sure that we have someone to blame.
Mackenzie Mays covers education in California for Politico. Thank you.
Thank you.
And joining me now is Steve Chiatakis, host of Greater LA, which is coming up in about 20 minutes from now. Hi there.
Welcome back, Madeline Brand.
Well, thanks. It's great to be back.
Yeah,
nice to see you.
Absolutely. Good to see you, too. Today on the show, you know how when we get older, I think the old saying is you can only count the true friends on your one hand, right? Don't they say that, like, as you go through life? Well, I don't know, because you have a whole entourage.
So
but
friends.
You do. You really do, Madeline. But you're certainly not getting older. But for some people, the phone can be a lifeline.
Right.
Can be, a lifeline for, like, communication, for camaraderie, whatever. There's one call center in the Philippines that actually offers this service for a fee. And older people can call.
Like phone a friend?
Like phone a friend, kind of.
Okay.
But it's at a call center in the Philippines. And people really don't know that. We'll talk about it coming up.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Coming up, why the music of the Carpenters is big in the Philippines. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Hanging around, nothing to do but frown. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down.
Well, this Monday isn't getting us down because we're going to talk about the Carpenters for our regular music segment. Well, one Carpenter at least, Karen, and how she played a central role in my next guest's life, Karen Tongson. Not only was Karen Tongson named after Karen Carpenter, but the Carpenters were central to Tongson's culture growing up in the Philippines. The Carpenters are absolute icons over there. They're played all over the country to this day. Karen Tongson teaches English at USC. She's just written a book called Why Karen Carpenter Matters, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, why did your mom name you after Karen Carpenter?
Well, I assume it's because she herself was a singer, and she also happened to be young. She was 18 when she had me. So an 18-year-old in 1973, especially in the Philippines, is prone to being a Carpenters fan. And I think that that fandom and the fact that her voice was so often compared to Karen Carpenter's really kind of tilted her in that direction. So instead of naming me after herself, it was someone who, I guess, was some kind of spiritual kindred spirit, rather, you know, vocally.
So she had a low voice.
She had a low voice. She still has a low voice, an alto voice.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing about Karen Carpenter is her voice, because they're such sweet songs, or they're described as sweet, like sugary, saccharine songs. And yet her voice is so deep. When there's no
the timbre of her voice, the quality of it, Dionne Warwick described it as the sound of smoking wood. And I think that it's the depth of that voice, the range of that voice, that is the thing that's kind of captured people's imaginations and has been a real enduring thing. And what makes people read sadness into it, even when she's singing very sunny and optimistic music.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Dionne Warwick, Close to You.
Yes.
So she sang that, and Burt Bacharach wrote that for Dionne Warwick, right?
Absolutely.
So she sang it originally. And then the Carpenters did a cover of it, which became their first breakout hit.
Yeah, the song never really did anything when Dionne Warwick recorded it and as a single. It didn't really ascend the charts. It was out in the 60s. And you know, it was ostensibly Richard Carpenter's arrangement, which gave it that frilly little piano lick and some of the other accoutrement that made it such a hit in the 70s.
Let's hear a little bit of Close to You.
Why do stars fall down from the sky every time you walk by? Just like me, they long to be.
And she's playing the drums.
She's playing the drums. You know, the thing that a lot of people who aren't Carpenters fans don't know is that Karen began as a drummer. So she wasn't always a vocalist. She was the drummer for Richard's other musical ensembles, like his jazz band, the Dick Carpenter Trio. And somehow through a series of various accidents, probably singing backup, etc., for Richard, they discovered Karen's low voice and they decided to kind of run with it. And they realized it was such a rich and beautiful thing that they could send her as part of their sound.
Now, their sound was kind of not taken seriously, shall we say, here by serious rock critics in the United States.
Yeah. Lester Bangs called them creepy.
Well, he also called them creepy because they were brother and sister and they were marketed as almost like a couple.
Yeah, there was a kind of vagueness to and a lack of understanding is how to like kind of promote a family act that was, you know, a brother and sister act. And Richard himself really complained about that quite frequently, that he's like, I can't believe they're like putting us in these romantic poses because we're brother and sister.
Then weren't they asked straight up if they were having a relationship?
Yeah, there's one radio DJ, I think from Toronto, if I remember correctly, like really ribbed them and asked them directly if there was anything untoward or taboo that they might be participating in with each other. And I think that that's something that, you know, for people who are supposedly so wholesome and, you know, kind of square, they were often addressing a kind of salacious range of questions in that way and having to engage that.
That's really interesting because they did present as just white bread America. I mean, they're from Downey, which is a white working class community here.
And originally from Connecticut, too. So it's not like they came from a place that was less white and moved to Downey, you know?
And they embodied that sound, that sound that was considered non-threatening.
The best of young America in Richard Nixon's words.
Is that how he described
them? That's how he described them, yeah, when they visited the White House.
So non-urban.
Non-urban.
Non-black. No screaming guitars.
At least not until Goodbye to Love.
This is at a time that comes, you know, right after Turbulent 60s and all that music, and then the 70s with disco.
Yeah.
And they are not that at all.
They're definitely not any of those things. As I read about in the book, Karen flirts with disco when she kind of strikes out on her own. But for the most part, I think what the Carpenters were doing is a kind of an homage to the Great American Songbook, and a Great American Songbook that began to include acts like the Beach Boys and the Beatles. They covered Ticket to Ride on their first album, and the Beach Boys' harmonic sound was certainly very much an inspiration to the Carpenters' own. But, you know, as actually, I can't remember who exactly said it, what, you know, it may have been Richard's songwriting partner, John Bettis, who said it, that a lot of people in, especially in the early 70s, in the wake of the 60s, were trying to be people who they weren't, especially white kids, right? They were trying to harness, you know, the countercultural, even if they came from these middle class white backgrounds. But the Carpenters themselves, they were suburban kids. They dressed like it. They looked like it. They sang like it. And they're sort of, they were kind of unapologetic and almost presented themselves naively as just that, you know. They're very honest in their presentation, in other words.
So for you, as someone who is not that.
Although I did grow up mostly in Southern California after the age of 10.
Okay. But
so I'm a Southern Californian.
You are, yeah. You are. Okay. But in general, well, you're not white.
Yes, definitely not.
And
although I don't know if anybody can hear that out there.
But what is it that made you, how did you relate to them in that on that level? Or did you relate to them on a different level?
I think that there were just different layers of that. I think that first and foremost, it was impossible for me to not relate to them, given that I was named after Karen Carpenter. There's an overdetermined relationship that happens when you have a namesake in that way. The other aspect of it is that I think, especially as Filipinos in the Philippines, when I was growing up there as a small kid, you know, we think about and look to America as a certain place that we know we have a deep and profound and sometimes complicated relationship to. And I know that this sounds a bit, you know, precocious of me to be thinking about this. It was all unconscious before the age of 10 when I moved here. But, you know, there's something about what the Carpenters sang about and represented that was this vision of America that was certainly had been peddled to us in other aspects of popular culture as post-colonial people in relation to the U.S. And so I think that, you know, in many respects, they were kind of exemplars presenting this ideal. When I moved to this country, I asked my parents, and this was the first time I ever came to the U.S., why my hair hadn't turned blonde yet. Because I just thought it automatically happened to you. But that whiteness was essential to, you know, being in the United States in some way. I kind of intuitively felt that. And I think that the Carpenters were part of that. And the songs that they sang about, which look back at these kind of halcyonic moments of Americana, are very much, you know, part of crafting that ideal of America in other places and in kind of places where the U.S. had post-colonial effects.
But instead of rebelling against that because you realize, well, oh, I see, my hair isn't turning blonde. This isn't the truth. There's a lot of misconception and a lot of, I don't know, fantasy involved here. You embrace it. You really like the music.
Yeah.
And you really find a complexity and a pathos to Karen Carpenter.
Well, I think that one of the funny things that happened is once I finally got here, and that was in 1983, so it was right after Karen Carpenter died, right? But the Carpenters' music hadn't been in vogue for a long time. So the fact that I knew this music and thought it was American music when other kids my age and other people I was around definitely disavowed the Carpenters' music made me associate the Carpenters with the Philippines. So I think that it wasn't just like this kind of identification with whiteness that was happening in my affection for them, but that in a way they became more emblematic of the Philippines to me and my experiences there as a small child hearing them in the 70s. Than, you know, a lot of other things because, you know, I was also kind of not well received for liking to listen to their music at that moment in the 80s.
Huh. So, but it was more than nostalgia.
It was, I think it's certainly more than nostalgia. I think that, I mean, I have an attachment to the her voice and the way it sounds. So there's all those other ephemeral things. I mean, I can intellectualize all the other stuff, but fundamentally, I think there's something really deeply affecting about her singing.
Yeah, and it's interesting that she's got this low voice. She's playing the drums. She's embodying a supposedly a feminine female ideal, and yet she's not in so many ways. And you talk a lot about queer culture and how there might be some kind of interesting overlap between that and your identity as a queer woman and Karen Carpenter.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that one comes to learn about Karen Carpenter, the more you look into her background, and also if you just kind of look more closely at their TV specials and things, is that Karen Carpenter was a tomboy. And she was a kind of tomboy from youth into the time that she was recording with the Carpenters. She was a drummer, which was super unusual, which struck people as a bit of gender trouble when they saw it. Even at the height of their popularity, Johnny Carson asked her, you know, like, it's kind of unusual, right, to be behind the drum there as a girl and stuff. And she'd get asked that question all the time. Eventually, she had to move out in front because people wanted to see her as the lead singer. But, you know, my sense of that kind of physicality that she brought to her drum playing, and even in the sketches that she did with Richard on their TV specials, when she would be playing the drums, you know, gave me a place to understand that it's possible to, you know, I don't know, experience joy and be out there in front of the world, even when you're doing things that aren't expected of your gender and that people question you about.
But she had such a tragic ending, and she died of a stereotypical female disease, anorexia, or complications related to anorexia.
Yeah, although one of the things that the book argues is that maybe we have to think about that apart from the kind of fear of the associations with, you know, like the beauty and femininity, but think about it instead as an attempt to maybe in her own way unsex her own body, because it's like one of their family friends talked about how when she saw Karen at the height of her struggles with the disease, you couldn't tell, quote unquote, you couldn't tell if she was a boy or a girl. Right. Or if it was a boy or a girl. And so I take that weird throwaway line in another conversation and kind of like think, well, what if this was about trying to shed those expectations of femininity, trying to no longer be just the pretty girl singer up in front, but to get back to that sort of unsexedness that comes when you are a drummer, a player, a musician, where you're not, you know, pinned to your femininity because you're up there representing the entire group with your voice and who you are and how you're moving. And so that's one of the bigger kind of speculations that I take in the book.
And for you, too, you talk about growing up in the Philippines and people not knowing if you were a boy or girl.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And then that, you know, that can be a very painful set of experiences over a durational period of time. But at some point you begin to understand how it can be a strength, or that it allows you to understand yourself in a more complicated way than what people expect of you.
Okay, and the Carpenters are still popular today in the Philippines?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I challenge anyone to step off the plane and go several hours without hearing them on the radio, in a car, in a bar. It's, you know, the ubiquity of their music there, along with other music from that era, too, I would have to say. It's stunning. And you know, I would argue, I don't have any stats to prove it, but they're the most popular there than they are anywhere in the world.
Did they know that at the time?
I mean, I'm assuming that they had a sense of that. I think that, you know, I know that they knew they were popular in Japan. They were popular in other parts of Asia. But Richard Carpenter went back there in 2009, probably has gone back since. I didn't really check on that. But like, he had a real big visit there. And, you know, he visited the sitting president. He was received like a true, you know, honorable emissary from the United States. And so I'm assuming that he must know.
Amazing.
That. Yeah.
How do you explain this adoration for the Carpenters?
I think it's very much tied to some of the things I talked about. You know, I think that there is at once there's the kind of historical relationship that you can flesh out between the U.S. and the Philippines, one that's kind of fraught because it's a colonial one. There is also the kind of the earnestness and sincerity with which we kind of accept Karen's voice and vocality is, you know, is in the wheelhouse of the kind of sentimental balladry that is so popular in the Philippines. And you know, I think that there are also other reasons, like, you know, that have to do with radio and armed forces radio being something that was so ubiquitous in the Philippines, you know, post World War II, essentially. And that, you know, just this music ensconced itself in people's hearts.
Well, Karen Tongson, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to have you in here.
Well, thank you for having me here and chatting with me and for reading the book as a True Carpenters fan.
As a True Carpenters fan. The book is called Why Karen Carpenter Matters by Karen Tongson.
Such a feeling's coming over me. There is wonder in most everything I see. Not a cloud in the sky. Got the sun in my eyes.
Yes, such a great way to start the week. And a great way to end the show. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Bram. I'll see you tomorrow.
Everything I want the world to be is now coming true, especially.